by way of underscoring George Bernard Shaw's political philosophy, a very important political philosophy, I'm going to play a section of a tape. I played this a few years ago, and I think there are some very, very profound insights into political, social, and intellectual reality, and I think those insights are vital for us to assimilate and to evaluate if we're going to survive personally as well as politically. There are a number of things in this particular tape that I would ask you to observe. It's about 15 or 20 minutes in length. I would note George Bernard Shaw's observations about the nature of intellectual reality, his observation that it is basically reactionary, and that if you want to be popular, you're going to have to do what everybody else does. However, if you do what everybody else does, you are going to share all of their faults, and that's a very, very important observation, in my opinion. I would also take note of George Bernard Shaw's observations that people basically, they basically do what everybody else does. That is one of the problems. And again, if you want to be popular, do what everybody else does, but you will also share their faults. I would also note that George Bernard Shaw emphasizes that if you deal with people you don't like, if you see things that you don't like, you should set about trying to correct those things, because that's what it's all about. Well, those are words of advice that I myself believe in very strongly, and I'm going to play you now this section of tape. And again, George Bernard Shaw is speaking upon the occasion of his 80th birthday, and he's talking to young students of the sixth form. He talks about school, he talks about the nature of intellectual reality, social reality, and ultimately an encouragement to commitment and to nonconformity. Again, as George Bernard Shaw said, reasonable people adapt themselves to the world, unreasonable people attempt to adapt the world to themselves. All progress, therefore, depends on unreasonable people. Well, in that context, I like to think of myself as an unreasonable person, and I would encourage you to become the same. The following tape segment comes about as close as I could to presenting Dave Emery's credo. This is a rigorous credo, one which I have lived up to only imperfectly to date. Indeed, I think the moral and intellectual and social principles presented by George Bernard Shaw would serve well as the established principles, the goals of a lifetime. And he lived to be considerably older than I am now. This was on the occasion of his 80th birthday. I'll be 43 in September. So those of you who are taping, get ready to go for about 15 or 20 minutes. This is George Bernard Shaw talking to young students.
Hello, Sixth. I have been asked to speak to you because I have become celebrated through my eminence in the profession of Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and Shakespeare. Aeschylus wrote in school Greek, and Shakespeare is English literature, which is a school subject. In French schools, I am English literature. Consequently, all the sixth forms in France shudder when they hear my name. However, don't be alarmed, I'm not going to talk to you about English literature. To me, there's nothing in writing a play. Anyone can write one if he has the necessary natural turn for it, and if he hasn't, he can't, and that's all there is to it. However, I have another trick for imposing on the young. I am old, over 80, in fact. Also, I have a white beard, and these two facts are somehow associated in people's minds with wisdom. That's a mistake. If a person is a born fool, the folly will get worse, not better, by a long life's practice. By having lived four times gives me only one advantage over you. I have carried small boys in my arms and girls and seen them grow into sixth form scholars, then into young men and women and the flower of youth and beauty, then into brides and bridegrooms who think one another much better and lovelier than they really are, then into middle-aged paterfamiliases and anxious mothers with elderly spreads. And finally, I've attended their cremations. Well, now, you mayn't think much of this, but just consider. Some of your schoolfellows may surprise you by getting hanged. Others, of whom you have the lowest opinion, will turn out to be geniuses and become one of the great men of your time. Therefore, always be nice to young people. Some little beast who is no good at games and whose head you may possibly have clouted for indulging a sarcastic wit and a sharp tongue at your expense may grow into a tremendous swell, like Rudyard Kipling. You never can tell. Well, it's no use, you know, reading about such things or being told about them by your father. You must have known the people personally, as I have. Now, that's what makes the difference between your outlook on the world and mine. When I was as young as you, the world seemed to me to be unchangeable, and a year seemed a long time. Now the years fly past before I have time to look round. I am an old, old man before I have got out of the habit of thinking of myself as a boy. You have 50 years before you, and therefore must think carefully about your future and about your conduct. I have no future, and need not care what I say or do. Now, you all think, don't you, that you're nearly grown up? I thought so when I was your age. And now, after 81 years of that expectation, I've not grown up yet. The same thing will happen to you. You will escape from school only to discover that the world is a bigger school and that you're back again in the first form. Before you can work your way up into the sixth again, you will be as old as I am. The hardest part of schooling is the earliest part, when you are a very small kid and have to be turned into a walking Radio Rector. You have to know up to 12 times 12 and how many shillings there are in any number of pence, up to 144, without looking at a book. And you must understand the printed page just as you understand people talking to you. That's a stupendous feat of sheer learning, much the most difficult I have ever achieved. Yet, I haven't the faintest recollection of being put through it, though I remember the governess who did it. I can't remember any time at which a printed page was unintelligible to me, nor at which I did not know without counting that 56 pence make 4 and 8. This seems so magical to me now that I sometimes regret that my governess did not teach me the whole table of logarithms and the binomial theorem and all the other mathematical shortcuts and redirectings as well. Perhaps she would have if she'd known them herself. It's strange that if you learn anything when you are young, you remember it forever. Now that I'm old, I forget everything in a few seconds, and everybody 5 minutes after they've been introduced to me. That's a great happiness, as I don't want to be bothered with new things and new people. But I still can't get on without remembering what my governess taught me. So cram in all you can while you're young. But I'm rambling. Let us get back to your escape from your school or your university into the great school of the world. And remember that you will not be chased and brought back. You will just be chucked out neck and crop and the door slammed behind you. You will find the new school a very disorderly one. What makes school life irksome until you get used to it, and easy when you do get used to it, is that it's a routine. You have to get up at a fixed hour, wash and dress, take your meals and do your work all at fixed hours. Now, the worst of a routine is that though it is supposed to suit everybody, it really suits nobody. Sixth form scholars are like other people. They are all different. Each of you is what is called an individual case, needing individual attention. But you can't have it at school. Nobody has time enough nor money enough to provide each of you with a separate teacher and a special routine carefully fitted to your individual personality, like your clothes and your boots. I can remember a time when English people going to live in Germany were astonished to find the German boots were not divided into rights and lefts. A boot was a boot, and it did not matter which foot you put it on, your foot had to make the best of it. You may think that funny, but let me ask how many of you have your socks knitted as rights and lefts. I've had mine knitted that way for the last 50 years. To get properly stuck into a money-making profession, you have to pass examinations, and this you must set about very clear-headedly or you will fail. You must not let yourself get interested in the subject or be overwhelmed by their magnitude and by the utter impossibility of any human being mastering them all. The scholar who knows everything is like the little child who is perfectly obedient and perfectly truthful. It doesn't exist, never will. Therefore, you must go to a crammer. Now, what is a crammer? A crammer is a person whose business in life is to study all the old examination papers and find out what are the questions that are actually asked and what are the answers expected by the examiner. You must be very careful not to suppose that these answers are always the true answer. Your examiners will be elderly gentlemen, and their knowledge is sure to be more or less out of date. Therefore, begin by telling yourself this story. Imagine yourself a young student early in the 15th century, and being examined as to your knowledge of the movements of the sun and moon, planets and stars, and so on. Imagine also that your father happens to know Copernicus, and that you have learned from his conversation that the planets go round not in circles, but in ellipses. Imagine, too, that you have met the painter Leonardo da Vinci, and been allowed to peep at his funny notebook, and by holding it up to a mirror, to read the words, "The Earth is a moon of the sun." Imagine that on being examined, you gave the answers of Copernicus and Leonardo, believing them to be the true answers. Instead of passing at the head of the successful list, you would have been burnt alive for heresy. Therefore, you would have taken good care to say that the stars and the sun move in perfect circles, because the circle is a perfect figure and therefore answers to the perfection of the Creator. You would say that the motion of the sun round the earth is proved by the fact that Joshua saw it move in Gibeon and stopped it. All your answers would be wrong, but you would pass and be patted on the head as a young marvel of Aristotelian science. Now, passing examinations today is just what it was in the days of Copernicus. If you at 20 years of age go up to be examined by an elderly gentleman of 50, you must find out what people were taught 30 years ago and stuff him with that, and not with what you are taught today. But you will say, how are you possibly to find out what questions are to be asked and what answers are expected when you can't? But a good crammer can. He can't get a peep at the papers beforehand, but he can study the old examination paper until he knows all the questions that the examiners have to keep asking over and over again. After all, their number is not infinite. If only you will swat hard enough to learn them all, you will pass with flying colors. Of course, you will not be able to learn them all, but your chances will be good in proportion to the number you learn. The danger of being plucked for giving up-to-date answers to elderly examiners is greatest in the technical profession. If you want to get into the Navy or practice medicine, you must get specially trained for some months in practices that are now quite out of date. If you don't, you'll be turned down by admirals dreaming of the Nelson touch, or surgical baronets brought up on the infallibility of Jenner and Lister and Pasteur. But this does not apply to all examinations. Take the classics, for instance. Homer's Greek and Virgil's Latin, being dead languages, they don't change in the way that naval and medical practice changes. Suppose you want to be a clergyman. Well, the Greek of the New Testament doesn't change. The creeds do not change. The 39 articles do not change, though they ought to, for some of them are terribly out of date. You can cram yourself with these subjects for yourself and save your money for lessons in elocution. In any case, you may take it as a safe rule that if you happen to have any original ideas about examination subjects, you mustn't air them in your examination papers. You may very possibly know better than your examiner, but do not let them find out that you think so. Once you are safely through your examination, you will begin life in earnest. You will then discover that your education has been very defective. You will find yourself uninstructed as to the best ways of eating and drinking and dressing and sleeping and breathing. Your notions of keeping yourself fit will consist mostly of physical exercises, which will shorten your life by 20 years or so. You may accept me as an educated man, Because I have earned my living for 60 years by work which only an educated man, and even a highly educated man, could do. Yet, the subjects that educated me were never taught in my school. Consequently, school was to me a sentence of penal servitude. You see, I was born with what people call an artistic temperament. I could read, all the masterpieces of the English poets, playwrights, historians, and scientific pioneers. But I could not read school books, because they're written by people who don't know how to write. To me, a person who knew nothing of all the great musicians, from Palestrina to Edward Elgar, nor of the great painters from Giotto to Burne-Jones, was a savage and an ignoramus, even if he were hung all over with gold medals for school classics. As to mathematics, to be imprisoned in an ugly room and set to do sums in algebra without ever having had the meaning of mathematics explained to me or its relation to science was enough to make me hate mathematics all the rest of my life, as so many literary men do. So don't expect too much from your school achievement. You may win the Ireland scholarship and then find that none of the great business houses will employ a university don on any terms. As to your general conduct and prospects, all I have time to say is that if you do as everyone does and think as everyone thinks, you will get on very well with your neighbor. But you will suffer from all their illnesses and stupidity. If you think and act differently, you must suffer their dislike and persecution. I was taught, when I was young, that if people would only love one another, all would be well with the world. Now this seems simple and very nice, but I found when I tried to put it in practice, not only that other people were seldom lovable, but that I was not very lovable myself. I also found that to love anyone is to take a liberty with them, which is quite unbearable, unless they happen to return your affection, which you have no right to expect. What you have to learn, if you are to be a good citizen of the world, is that though you will certainly dislike many of your neighbors, and differ from some of them so strongly that you could not possibly live in the same house with them, that does not give you the smallest right to injure them, or even to be personally uncivil to them. You must not attempt to do good to those who hate you, for they don't need your officious service and would refuse to be under any obligation to you. Your difficulty will be how to behave to those whom you dislike and cannot help disliking for no reason whatever, simply because you were born with an antipathy to that sort of person. Well, you must just keep out of their way as much as you can. And when you cannot, deal as honestly and civilly with them as with your best friend. Just think what the world would be like if everyone who disliked you were to punch your head. The other thing about it is that you will find yourself making friends with people whose opinions are the very opposite to your own, whilst you cannot bear the sight of others who share all your beliefs. You may love your dog and find your nearest relatives detestable. So don't waste your time arguing whether you ought to love all your neighbors. You can't help yourself, and neither can they. You may find yourself completely dissatisfied with all your fellow creatures as they exist at present, and with all their laws and institutions. Then there's nothing to be done but set to work to find out exactly what is wrong with them and how to set it right. That's perhaps the best fun of all. But perhaps I think so only because I'm a little in that line myself.
Well, that basically concludes the talk by George Bernard Shaw. And again, I think there is much to be evaluated and emulated in that particular talk. It's as close to Dave Emery's credo as you're ever going to hear. And I think that many of the things he said are absolutely essential for our understanding if we are going to extricate ourselves from the present situation. For many years on this broadcast, I have been discussing the assassination of President Kennedy. It was an extremely important political event. It was basically a fascist coup in the United States. Kennedy had run afoul of many powerful elements in this country, including the national security establishment or large elements of it, and they ultimately took his life. And the significance of studying the Kennedy assassination is to understand, first of all, that there is a continuity of covert action from what the United States does abroad to what it does at home. Many liberals and conservatives as well accept that the United States and its intelligence system and military foment coups and set up death squads in other parts of the world, the Third World in particular. But yet there remains an enormous blind spot that if the U.S. national security establishment will do that to preserve its hegemony and that of the multinational corporations abroad, they will certainly do that here, and they have done it and have been doing it for a long time. It's also worth understanding the assassination of President Kennedy in order to understand that the core group of that coup were basically fascists. In The Guns of November Part 4, in Radio Free America shows 11, 12, 13, 15, and the miscellaneous archive show called Lee Harvey Oswald, Edwin Walker, and the Fourth Reich, I go into the numerous Nazi connections and fascist connections to President Kennedy's assassination. In addition to elements associated with the Galen spy organization, the Nazi Eastern Front intelligence outfit, which was brought into the United States at the end of World War II, elements associated with the closely intersecting anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations put together by Adolf Hitler in 1943, as well as domestic fascists, were deeply involved in the assassination of John Kennedy. The people who killed Kennedy were explicitly fascist, many of them Nazis. But to give you an idea of just how extreme the political views of that coup group were, a fellow named George de Morenshield, who was one of the Oswald family's many babysitters in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, de Morenshield had been a German spy during World War II. He had been arrested, although never convicted or even indicted as far as I know, but he had been arrested for spying on the Aransas Pass Coast Guard station during World War II. He was very close to Baron Konstantin Meidel and worked with him. Meidel, for a time, was in charge of all Abwehr activities in North America, the Abwehr being the Third Reich's military and intelligence service. It should be noted that de Morenshield's father used to call himself George von Morenshield, but when World War II broke out, he changed it because it was not fashionable to have a von in your name. His father had managed the Baku oil fields for the Nobel family in Tsarist Russia. After the war, he went to work for U.S. intelligence, but one of the other White Russian Galen ABN-associated people who were involved with handling the Oswalds, a fellow named Ilya Mamontov, M-A-M-A-N-T-O-V, in speaking of George de Morenshield, now bear in mind, George de Morenshield was a Tsarist and a German spy during World War II, a pretty ripe piece of fruit all in all. In referring to de Morenshield, Mamontov referred to him as an Eisenhower Republican and a leftist in the same breath. Kennedy was viewed as a card-carrying communist by the people who ultimately took his life. He did pursue a Cold War policy in many ways. That has been a source of criticism on the part of many on the left of John Kennedy. They ignore the fact that anyone who was going to be elected president of the United States in 1960 would have to have been a Cold Warrior, otherwise they simply would not have been elected. Fact of the matter is, John Kennedy ran afoul of the national security establishment in a variety of ways. He refused to provide air cover for the Bay of Pigs invasion in 1961. In March of, he then fired much of the leadership of the CIA, including Alan Dulles, who was CIA director, and lied to Kennedy about the Bay of Pigs. Alan Dulles later served in the Warren Commission, supposedly investigating his assassination. In 1962, of course, that firing much of the leadership of the CIA did not endear him to that institution. It should also be noted that Kennedy in 1962 proposed joint space exploration between the United States and Soviet Union. That was absolute heresy in 1962. Later, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy refused to either bomb or invade Cuba and opted for a blockade instead. That greatly angered the military, who wanted him to use more force. Kennedy in 1963 was moving in the direction of detente with the Soviet Union, made a very important speech at American University in which he acknowledged the Soviet Union's sacrifices during World War II. That speech made a tremendous stir in the Soviet Union. In August of 1963, Kennedy signed the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, the first substantive arms limitation agreement between the United States and the USSR. That was bitterly opposed by the military, and what that did was oblige both the U.S. and USSR to stop testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, which they used to do because basically nuclear fallout was being distributed around the world. Kennedy also was working in the direction of a diplomatic rapprochement with Castro's Cuba. A quid pro quo had been set up. Castro, although a socialist, was also a Cuban nationalist, and he recognized that ultimately the best thing for his country would be to have at least a non-hostile, if not friendly, relationship with the enormous power to its north. Kennedy, in turn, wanted to move Castro away from the Soviet Union, so a quid pro quo had been set up. The Kennedy administration had set up a back channel, a backdoor diplomatic channel to Cuba, and Castro, in exchange for moving away from the international communists in his own circle, was going to receive from the United States not only diplomatic recognition, but Kennedy was going to take responsibility on behalf of the United States for the brutal dictatorship of Cuban dictator Fulgencio Batista, which in fact was set up by the United States. And this greatly angered not only the CIA, but the anti-Castro Cuban community as well. And Kennedy also was moving in the direction of pulling the United States out of Vietnam. He issued National Security Action Memorandum 263 in October of 1963 that called for a phased withdrawal of all U.S. personnel from Vietnam by Christmas of 1965. And then 4 days after he was killed, the troop withdrawal was canceled by NSA 273, and troop increases and covert operations were scheduled. I have read those documents into the record in their entirety, and in The Guns of November Part 3 and Addenda to it, you can examine those, as well as hearing from Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, who was in charge of special operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and who drew up the report from which President Kennedy made his decision for a phased withdrawal from Vietnam. Kennedy certainly was a cold warrior in many respects. Again, no one was going to be elected president in 1960 without being a cold warrior. But all of those things greatly, greatly angered the military, and ultimately they took the law into their own hands and they eliminated President Kennedy. Tragically, however, anyone who examines President Kennedy's assassination has to run the gauntlet of not only being called a fool or a kook, but basically being, to a certain extent, personally and politically ostracized. Anyone who was willing to deal with the truth of Kennedy's assassination is going to be read out not only of the mainstream media and culture, but in fact the progressive media as well dump all over anyone who goes near the Kennedy assassination. During the recent furor over the Oliver Stone film JFK, I would note that both Oliver Stone and the New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison came under fire from the progressive political community just as much as they did from the mainstream media and the government itself. Such publications as The Nation magazine, In These Times, Z magazine, The Progressive, the SF Weekly, all of these publications joined together, and many of their pundits joined together to dump all over Oliver Stone and Jim Garrison. This is singularly unfortunate because when any group of people chooses to ignore its own history, they do so at their own peril. And in many ways, ignoring the events of 11-22-63 has gotten us to the present situation. We experienced not only a coup, but a fascist coup, and the results of that coup are very much with us and very much with a great many other people, both living and dead, around the world. Unfortunately, though, it remains a basic principle of intellectual orthodoxy that Kennedy, there was no conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination despite massive evidence to the contrary, and in particular on the part of progressive political forces, Kennedy is viewed as a demon and somebody who basically, if he was killed, good riddance to bad rubbish. And it is unfortunate that this is the case because I think, frankly, not only the mainstream media and mainstream intellectual culture, but also the progressive community, I usually call it the so-called progressive community, has basically clung to this untenable position of intellectual orthodoxy to everyone's peril. I received a letter a couple of weeks ago from a listener. It was actually a copy of a letter from Professor Noam Chomsky of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chomsky is something of a deity on the American left, and Chomsky has done some very, very good work. However, he also has taken some very destructive intellectual positions, and with the permission of this listener, a very supportive listener, I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs from this Chomsky letter. And again, this individual in question is a good friend of Noam Chomsky's and a professional colleague, because I think it illustrates the destructiveness of intellectual orthodoxy and the unwillingness on the part of not only more reactionary people and mainstream people, but included, it demonstrates the unwillingness of the progressive political community to deal with a documented political reality. In his book, Heartland, comedian Mort Saul, one of the early critics of the Warren Commission, asked the question, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And in the speech, or in the talk by George Bernard Shaw that you heard, he talked about what one must do if one wishes to be intellectually and personally popular. You have to conform. If you were a sixth-form student in the 15th century and you were aware of Copernicus and Leonardo da Vinci, if you said that, in fact, the Earth revolved around the sun rather than the other way around, you would be burned as a heretic. If, on the other hand, you said that the sun and the planets and the stars revolved around the Earth in perfect circles or on perfect spheres because the circle is a perfect figure and thereby reflects the perfection of the Creator, and the proof of this was that Joshua was able to make the sun stand still in the sky, as George Bernard Shaw noted, you would be deemed a marvel of Aristotelian, a young marvel of Aristotelian science. Well, just such intellectual orthodoxy has victimized us, and by way of offering some constructive criticism, not just, and by the way, I want to emphasize I'm not singling out Noam Chomsky, his intellectual shortcomings, I think, are shared by a great many other people, and rather than viewing this as a personal indictment, although I have many criticisms of him, rather I think this exemplifies a sort of intellectual and political orthodoxy which has brought us, to a large extent, to our very, very sorry state. In this particular letter to a colleague, Chomsky writes, about JFK on the Vietnam pullout, the theory hasn't a leg to stand on. What minimal credibility it might have had is undermined by the documents that have appeared in a flood in the past few years. On Cuba policy, Kennedy continued the dual track, testing the waters in terror. LBJ canceled the terror. The no-invasion deal was largely fraud. Kennedy promised nothing. The test ban treaty merely regularized testing by JFK standards. Reagan was an anti-nuclear activist. These are all fairy tales, in my opinion. You could make a much better case that the right wing should have tried to assassinate Johnson or Reagan or Nixon. In my view, the left is caught up in fantasies rather similar to the Ross Perot fantasies, a kind of cargo cult. Perhaps not surprising under the current conditions of disillusionment and marginalization, but dangerous and unfortunate nonetheless. Kennedy was a gangster and the right wing knew it. Apart from kooky elements that regard Nixon and Reagan as closet commies, there were no notable elements that might have been involved in assassinating Kennedy for political reasons as far as I can see. That last sentence again, because it's a real doozy. Apart from kooky elements that regard Nixon and Reagan as closet commies, there were no notable elements that might have been involved in assassinating Kennedy for political reasons as far as I can see. And then Professor Chomsky goes on to say, as for the assassination, I haven't been through the masses of details, but I have seen enough to convince me that much of the conspiracy story is based on very dubious evidence. If you took a physics experiment and subjected it to close scrutiny, you'd find all kinds of patchwork and scotch tape to make things work. If you take something as messy as this, you'll find tons of such things. By such logic, one could probably demonstrate that Hinckley's attempt to assassinate Reagan was a CIA plot covered up by the establishment. I'm going to write something about the foreign policy side of this, already had something brief in Lies of Our Times. I've decided to keep away from the assassination issue, however. First, I don't think it is of any more importance than the latest murder in Roxbury. Second, it's like having a discussion with religious maniacs. Facts and arguments just don't matter. Not worth it. And then he gives his regards. Well, this is not only, virtually everything Chomsky says here is not only demonstrably false from the political record, his disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding, but much of it is, I think, frankly, quite hypocritical from an intellectual standpoint. Let's take what he says here a piece at a time. First of all, as far as JFK and the Vietnam pullout, Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, again, who drew up the documents, the report, I should say, from which Kennedy made his withdrawal decision, he's confirmed this. Kennedy's Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs has confirmed this. The brilliant Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott has written a landmark piece called The Kennedy Assassination of the Vietnam War, that in the book The Kennedy of the Assassinations from Dallas and Beyond. I have covered that in the Guns of November Part 3, plus the documents themselves have been released, and on paragraph 6 In paragraph 6 on page 2 of NSA 273, it states that the magnitude and effectiveness of American assistance must not be allowed to fall below the levels of the Diem regime. Operating from memory here on that. Well, when you're talking about magnitude, you're talking about size. The Diem regime ended on November 2nd, 1963, with Diem's assassination. The initial pullout of 1,000 military police personnel was to have been effected in December of 1963. That canceled the troop withdrawal. Paragraph 7 refers to the 34A program of covert operations against North Vietnam, which ultimately resulted in the Gulf of Tonkin incident and the whole bloody escalation under Lyndon Baines Johnson. There's also a new book called JFK in Vietnam by John Newman, which has much excellent documentation. Again, with regard to Cuba, Kennedy canceled Operation Mongoose in the summer of 1963, a guerrilla warfare program against Castro's Cuba, and Kennedy administration diplomats, as well as Fidel Castro himself, has confirmed the overtures. When Castro heard Kennedy was shot, he was meeting with a French journalist named Jean Daniel and was discussing the deal proposed by Kennedy. And to poo-poo the atmospheric test ban treaty, again, the military opposed that bitterly. It kept nuclear weapons from being tested in the atmosphere, for which we are all very much the better. And I think that the assessment here by Chomsky, apart from kooky elements that regard Nixon and Reagan as closet commies, there were no notable elements that might have been involved in assassinating Kennedy for political reasons, as far as I can see. Well, that is just demonstrably false. One of the things that the Warren Commission did, and by the way, I would note that the Warren Report itself is blasted into smithereens by the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. The Warren Report itself was authored by a fellow named Rudolf August Winokur, who was head of the Pentagon's historical department. He was a German-born former OSS agent. Also note that the preface, the introduction to the Warren Report, was written by Louis Neisser, who prosecuted the Rosenbergs. But the Warren Report itself is completely destroyed by the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits. In an executive session of the Warren Commission, they were discussing whether or not to release the 26 volumes of testimony and exhibits, and Alan Dulles, again, former CIA director fired by President Kennedy for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs, Alan Dulles said, basically, people don't read anymore. Don't think people read. A few professors will read the record. Most people will read very little. He then went on to say that if you don't release the 26 volumes of testimony and exhibits, then people will accuse you of a cover-up, but if you do release them but don't index them, which is what they did, then nobody will read them, and away you go. A few professors will read the record. That apparently does not include Professor Noam Chomsky. Something that I find really grotesque here is Chomsky's admission that he hasn't been through the body of documentation about the Kennedy assassination, and an example of begging the question, where he says, if you took a physics experiment and subjected it to close scrutiny, you'd find all kinds of patchwork and Scotch tape to make things work. If you take something as messy as this, you'll find tons of such things. By such logic, one could probably demonstrate that Hinckley's attempt to assassinate Reagan was a CIA plot covered up by the establishment. There are distinct indications that that may have been the case, not necessarily that it was. I refer listeners to the program that I did about George Bush and the assassination of President Reagan, pointing out the numerous connections between the Hinckley family and the Bush family, and some of the odd aspects of John Hinckley's behavior, his membership in the American Nazi Party, and a number of other indications that that may have been the case. Not that it absolutely was, but there are indications it may have been the case. The fact of the matter is, there's a massive body of evidence proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination. Again, the badly compromised House Select Committee on Assassinations found a 95% probability of a plot behind Kennedy's assassination, and they recommended to the Department of Justice that, among other things, they begin investigating David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in the New Orleans area. David Ferry was who Jim Garrison was after. In Garrison's court, I should say, Colonel Fink, one of the autopsy surgeons, testified that he was ordered by unnamed superior officers not to dissect Kennedy's neck wound. That is unimpeached legal testimony in an American court of law and has the power of law. The jury found that there had been a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination, but could not find beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was involved. The Garrison investigation was massively subverted by a number of elements, some of which I will speak about during the course of the broadcast this evening. But the body of evidence that there, in fact, was a conspiracy is absolutely airtight. It is massive. There are many questionable areas that need to be looked into, what I like to call food for thought and grounds for further research. We will touch on some of those this evening. But the Warren Commission's thesis, their contention that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone nut assassin, is absolutely untenable in all of its major respects, and it is physically impossible in virtually all of its major respects. It rests on the so-called single bullet theory, or as critics have aptly termed it, the magic bullet theory. The Warren Commission had to limit itself to three shots in something like 6 seconds. If more than three shots were fired, then the Warren Commission had to admit that there was more than one rifleman. One shot blew Kennedy's head off, one missed the motorcade altogether and wounded a bystander named James Tague, and that left all seven non-fatal wounds in President Kennedy and Governor John Connally to be made by one bullet, the so-called magic bullet. Well, the residua recovered from those seven non-fatal wounds, supposedly made by the same bullet, exceeds the amount of material missing from that bullet. There's a basic principle of mathematics that the whole is equal to the sum of its parts. The sum of the parts cannot, under any circumstances, be greater than the whole. So much for the Warren Commission's thesis. All of the other aspects are of the Warren Commission's thesis are ridiculous as well. That bullet executed several sharp turns in mid-air without being acted upon by an external force, in direct contravention of the law of inertia. Bullets do all sorts of interesting things in what are known as fascia, or tissue layers, but they do not turn in mid-air without being acted upon by an external force. That is impossible. All the other aspects of the Warren Commission's thesis were equally ridiculous. The rifle that Oswald supposedly used to assassinate President Kennedy was sighted in for a left-handed shooter. Oswald was right-handed. He wouldn't have been able to hit the broadside of a barn. Paraffin tests on Oswald were negative, indicating he hadn't fired a gun. The Dallas police, who first searched Oswald's alleged sniper perch, found a rifle without a scope that they termed a 7.65 millimeter German Mauser, and one can go on and on. And again, the 26 volumes of Warren Commission testimony and exhibits completely destroy the Warren Commission in and of itself, as well as the magnificent body and the massive body of research developed by many private investigators in the years since. I find it very hypocritical that Chomsky says, well, he hasn't really examined the masses of details, and says basically he's not going to go into the assassination issue because, he says, first, I don't think it is of any more importance than the latest murder in Roxbury. Second, it's like having a discussion with religious maniacs. Facts and arguments just don't matter. Not worth it. Well, I think Chomsky's own words apply very, very well to his own blindness on this particular issue. And again, this is not to say that the man hasn't done some good work in other respects. He has. But this sort of knee-jerk intellectual orthodoxy, without a shred of evidence to stand on, and admitting that he has not examined the body of evidence, doesn't intend to do so, because it's like arguing with religious fanatics, well, I think the same argument could well be applied to Noam Chomsky. That is very discouraging to see one of America's foremost progressive intellectuals talking like this. But again, this is the type of intellectual orthodoxy that has long victimized human intellectual and political life. I suspect that if Noam Chomsky, particularly with his contempt for physics experiments, had existed in the 15th century, he would have advocated the burning of Copernicus and Galileo for heresy. Certainly, he is functioning in an intellectual respect that way now, to all of our detriment, including Noam Chomsky's. I've also been very critical of Chomsky in the past on other subjects. I find his criticisms of